When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
While the world whizzes by, enjoy a moment of me time with Tim Horton's $6 breakfast bundle. Savor a small hot or iced coffee, then add your choice of a mouth-watering hot breakfast sandwich and a crispy golden hash brown and your pick of a classic donut.
Yeah,
all for $6, all just for you. Make your mornings all about me time with our $6 breakfast bundle. Available at your neighborhood Tim Hortons. Price and participation vary. Terms apply.
This is The Crossover, an NBA show hosted by Sports Illustrated's Chris Mannix and Howard Beck.
It's a whole new level for you and me, Chris, this relationship.
Like and subscribe for the best weekly NBA content these two are capable of.
What does that mean?
Could be the best duo ever.
I don't see how you can beat that.
Here they are, Chris Mannix and Howard Beck.
Welcome back, Crossover NBA Podcast, Chris Mannix and Howard Beck, and this is one of the biggest shows of the year, Beck. Not only do we have an all-NBA caliber guest, you speak to Trae Young of the Atlanta Hawks later in the show, we are going to reveal our MVP ballots. We're also going to do other awards. We're going to do Defensive Player of the Year. We're going to do Coach of the Year. We're going to do Rookie of the Year. But the big one is the MVP, and this is going to be one of the most interesting MVP votes that we've seen, I think, in some time. Nikola Jokic enters the voting as the favorite. Joel Embiid, Giannis Antetokounmpo are right there in the mix. Let me ask you this before we get too deep in the weeds on it. How long did it take you to file this ballot? In other words, this was due Monday night at 11:59 p.m. When did you hit that submit button on your ballot?
I tend to go right up till the end. And I will say, like, all the way through the final weekend, I was still, like, just tortured over this decision on MVP and a couple other ones, frankly. But I had by the time Monday night came, I had a good idea of where I was going. I think I hit send, it was probably about 10 o'clock, 10:30. I didn't actually go to the last minute. I have before gone to the last minute, the literal last minute. I spared Mark Broussard, our friend in NBA PR, from the panicky texts at 11:57 saying, hey, haven't seen your ballot yet, which they're great about reminding us. But I did it with about 90 minutes to spare this time, I think.
Yeah, I think I was right around there, too. You and I were having a text back and forth over the all NBA positions there. I called a few people in the league office to get their take on it as well. So it was about 90 minutes to 2 hours before that I finally submitted my ballot. So we're going to get into that in a moment. But Howard, you correctly predicted last week that it would not be the last time that we talked about the Los Angeles Lakers. And here we are, days after the end of the NBA regular season, a week after the Lakers were officially limited from playoff contention. And we're going to talk about the Los Angeles Lakers because I know. Because they had their end of the season exit interviews with the media on Monday. And they were kind of bizarre. I think that's a good way to put it. A couple things stood out to me, and I want you to weigh in on this. I also wrote about this over at SI.com, so check out that story as well. Two things stand out off the top. One, the Lakers continue to push this narrative that they would have been so much better if Russell Westbrook, LeBron James, and Anthony Davis had played together more. You've heard Anthony Davis say it for several days now. LeBron James, he said something to the effect, like, the reason we are where we are is because we didn't play enough damn games together. He likened the number of games they played together, which was 21, to being less than the number of games he played in high school. Davis has said a lot of the same things as well. That's just not true. The Lakers were 11-10 in the games that LeBron, Russ, and AD played in. They had a negative rating in the 393 minutes that they played together, minus 3.5. They weren't very good. In fact, they were the definition of average. So that argument is just crazy. Of course, if Davis plays more games, if LeBron plays more games, they're a better team. Maybe they're at least in the play-in, if not in the playoff field. But they are not a contender in the Western Conference with more games together. It was very clear from watching them play that that group didn't work. The other takeaway I had, Russell Westbrook, I don't know what goes through his mind when he's asked to assess what happened during the season. You know, Russ came out and look, to his credit, said, I didn't play as well as I should have played this year. But then, as the questions continued, he started to talk about how he didn't connect with Frank Vogel. Frank Vogel didn't really like him. He told some story about how he sent Frank Vogel a bottle of champagne on his anniversary. Like, that should have, you know, made Frank Vogel do whatever he said during the regular season. He talked about how he never got to, you know, do the whole let Russ be Russ thing because, as LeBron and AD suggested, he kind of pushed the blame around and made it seem like it had more to do with how he was coached and the role he was put in than the fact that this guy is on the downside of his career and won't change, won't do anything, or at least anywhere close to enough to change the way he plays to make himself a modern NBA player capable of contributing to a winning roster. So those were my two takeaways from the Lakers exit interviews, Howard. Where did you come off on that?
Oh, man. Everybody's in denial. Like, the common theme of the day is everyone's in denial and no one is taking full responsibility, even when they say things like, the responsibility is on all of us, we all have to blah, blah, blah. Like, no one is actually literally taking responsibility. And I don't necessarily expect anyone to. Like, I don't expect Rob Pelinka to sit there and tell us, yeah, the Westbrook trade was a mistake, even though the whole world knows it was. Or to say we should have kept Alex Caruso, even though the whole world knows they should have. No one's going to say that the experiment failed. He was asked a couple different ways about, you know, firing Vogel and why it was justified. He had no substantive answers. It was kind of like, this is not the day to discuss. When is the day to discuss that? I don't know when that would be. So Rob Pelinka is not taking responsibility for a clearly flawed roster that the whole league could see was flawed from day one. Russell Westbrook is not taking responsibility for not finding a better way to fit in. Letting Russ be Russ is not fitting in. Letting Russ be Russ is Russ just doing what he's always done, which has, for the last several years, not really gotten the teams he's been on anywhere productive. And especially at the stage of his career and playing with LeBron James and Anthony Davis, he needed to adjust more. I don't know why anybody expected he was going to. He only knows one way. And in his partial defense, because it's not unusual for NBA players who have his level of talent, if this is what got you to the league and what got you to multiple All-NBA teams and multiple All-Star teams and got you multiple massive contracts, if the core of your success is doing things your way, it's really hard to decide one day to change, even later in your career. It's rare. It's very rare. And so I don't necessarily, I don't want to say I don't blame him for that. You would hope he would want to evolve and adjust to the situation. He did not. It's still on the Lakers for deciding to make the move for him in the first place and thinking that it would work. So with no responsibility from Russ, no responsibility from Rob Pelinka, no real responsibility from, you know, LeBron or anybody else. Like, I don't know, you know, maybe internally the Lakers are actually coming to terms with their failures and how they screwed up. And maybe they're doing some more self-examination. They certainly are not doing it in public, Chris.
No, they're not. Two other things. One, the way the Lakers handled the firing of Frank Vogel was absolutely shameful. Shameful. Vogel gets hit with the news just before his end-of-season press or end-of-game press conference after the Lakers, in about as spirited a game as they've played in months, beat the Nuggets in overtime. Kind of a feel-good moment for a lot of the young guys on that team to get a win at the end of the season. Vogel is hit after the game with a report that he was going to be fired, and it was going to be told to him on Monday. He said afterwards he hadn't been told Chit specifically there. I know a lot of people that have seen this from like Zombie Deadspin and others are like blaming Woj over at ESPN who reported it. Like, give me a break. It's your job to report the news. What was shameful was that when that report came out, Rob Pelinka didn't immediately get on the phone. Jeannie Buss didn't immediately get on the phone and speak to Vogel right then and there. They left him twisting in the wind, in a way, for like 14 hours until they sat down with him on Monday morning and officially let him go. Now, Vogel, trust me, was not surprised by this news, but I thought that was just a shameful way to humiliate a coach that brought you a championship, that coached a team 18 months ago that won a championship and brought title number 17 to LA. So that to me was shameful. One last thought on Westbrook. Like, it's possible, and I don't know what the percentage is, but it's possible that Russell Westbrook has played his last game in the NBA. Because, you know, look, the Lakers, they'll explore a trade for Russ. No, nobody, you know, even LeBron. LeBron is like, you know, he praises Russ. Then when he's asked directly, does he think that group should come back, specifically with Russ, he kind of punts on that and says, I don't make decisions for the front office, yada, yada, yada. The Lakers are going to try to trade him. It's going to be a very soft market, to say the least. He's going to pick up that option worth $47 million. And to move off him, the Lakers are going to have to attach an asset, be it a young player or a draft pick. And they've been reluctant to do that, at least before the trade deadline this past season. So if Russ is not back with the Lakers, wherever he gets traded to, most likely that team is going to buy him out. And who picks him up from there, Howard? Like, you look around the league. And could the Knicks be crazy enough to do it? Maybe, but they are just, they're coming off a truly dysfunctional season. They want to add a player as volatile as Westbrook to the mix. Like Westbrook and Tom Thibodeau, I don't know how that's going to work. I've heard some people in the league say Charlotte, he's got a long relationship with Jordan through the Jordan brand. I don't know why you'd add Russ to a team that already has LaMelo Ball with the ball in his hands. Outside of that, where are we looking? Like, Sacramento? Are they going to do it? No, they've got De'Aaron Fox in that mix. One of the bottom feeding teams, Houston? Oh, no, that wouldn't be good. Orlando? No, probably not down there. I just don't see the team that Russell Westbrook latches onto. Do you? I mean, I think it's more likely than not, given that he's under contract for next year and buyouts can be complicated, trades can be complicated. We see Russell Westbrook back in the NBA. But there's at least a small percentage that, you know, he could go the Iverson route and play like in Turkey next year or somewhere in an overseas market.
This is reminding me a lot. I'm glad you brought up Iverson because it's the first thing that I've thought of too. It reminds me of Iverson. Reminds me even a little bit of where Carmelo was a few years ago when it didn't work out with the Rockets. They trade him. He gets cut loose. Nobody picks him up for a while. And similar in that aging star, used to having the entire offense and the franchise revolve around him, doesn't really know another way, hard time adjusting to that. And to his credit, Carmelo Anthony eventually did and had some productive seasons in Portland. And then even, you know, amid an otherwise dismal season in LA, Carmelo was good, at least offensively. But ball dominant stars who are used to having things all cater to them often have a hard time at the end doing things differently, which is why it was so impressive when, you know, Paul Pierce, from his Nets tenure, as brief as it was, to the Wizards, to the Clippers, you know, played a role as a veteran, as a mentor, as a guy who brought some championship experience to teams. Vince Carter, what he did all the way into his 40s as a guy who had been a superstar. I admire the guys who find a way to be productive in a different kind of role later in their career. But not everybody can do it, Chris. Iverson was out of the league much sooner than he should have been. Partially physical stuff, but a lot of it had to do with he just could not deal with being a sixth man. And he said so outright. And I can't see Westbrook, given what we just saw, when you're playing next to LeBron James, one of the greatest of all time, and you still can't figure out a way to adjust your game to make it mesh, then there's only a couple possibilities here, right? Like, the contending teams aren't going for Westbrook. The middling teams are probably in various states of putting something together that is starting to work. the really, really bad teams, you know, they're probably more invested in their young draft picks that they just got. It really is hard without going through all 29 other teams. It's really hard to find a spot for him. And like, it sounds extreme, Chris. It sounds very hot takey when you say, is his NBA career over? But it's not. It's not a hyperbolic question, rhetorical question to ask, because at this stage of his career, given his inefficiency, given how disastrous this was in LA, given his contract, which, okay, fine, you know, he gets traded and bought out, or he just gets straight bought out, whatever, someone can sign him for the minimum. But where does he make sense? I do not have an answer to that question.
I've looked, Howard, I've looked at like all the 29 other teams. I mean, like, would Washington bring him back? Probably not. Not even at a reduced salary. I just don't see it. Like, Oklahoma City, they've got too much going on with their young players. They don't want to add Russ to the mix. Like, he's made it clear that the problem with the teams he's been on has more to do with them than him. And with the Lakers specifically, that's to do with coaching. Like, if you're an NBA head coach and your GM discusses Russell Westbrook with you, you're looking back at what happened with Frank Vogel. Frank Vogel, if nothing else, is a player's coach. He built a strong relationship with Paul George when he was leading those Indiana teams. Paul George, for years, has sworn by him. He built a strong relationship with LeBron. Anthony Davis, on Monday, was effusive in his praise of Frank Vogel, saying he's one of the top coaches he's played for and one of the guys he's enjoyed being coached by the most, including all the assistants Davis has had over the years. So if you're saying you didn't connect with Vogel, I got to believe that has more to do with you than has to do with Frank Vogel. Like, and for a guy, Howard, that Russ didn't connect with, he played 78 games. He started all 78, and Frank Vogel played him for 34 minutes per game. Like, and only once was there a hiccup along the way where Vogel sat Russ at the end of a fourth quarter because he had to, because Russ was just not working for him. I would argue that Vogel did everything possible to make it work with Russell Westbrook. And maybe he did ask Russ to change, but as we all know, he has to change. To stay in the league and be a productive player on a winning team, he has to change. So I thought Russ's comments were just wild. And I think those comments will probably be held against him if he winds up on the free agent market and teams start to evaluate whether to bring him in.
Yeah, I mean, where in all of that was there any sense of personal responsibility, of accountability, of self-reflection? There isn't. And I don't think we should expect it, because that's not been his track record. It seems like it's always everybody else's fault except for his. I don't care how many bottles of champagne he sent to Frank Vogel and his wife. That's a very nice gesture.
How weird was that? Like, how weird was that? It was like, it's like that happened in the preseason after Russell was acquired. Yeah. And like, he transitioned immediately to like, he's like, I didn't ask for anything in return. And then he couldn't connect with Vogel. Like, is that supposed to, that was such a bizarre anecdote to use in that situation.
Yeah, it was just this transparent play to say, look, I'm a good guy. And I tried to, you know, it's obviously his fault since I tried to connect with him and he didn't connect with me or something. But I don't even care if a player and coach connect, especially when you're not the star of the team. There are two guys who are more important than you on that team that Frank Vogel needs to connect with. You're a role player on this team. Maybe that's the issue. He doesn't see himself as a role player, but he is. And the other two stars have had no problem getting along fine with Frank Vogel. So, and you know, to everything else you said, Paul George, everybody else, like there's no, Frank Vogel's not the issue. Frank Vogel wasn't the issue. Frank Vogel's now gone. And so he won't be the issue. The Lakers still have a Westbrook problem. The bottom line is they have to figure out if there's a way to trade him without giving up too many other assets. Can they get anything of value back in that deal? And if not, what do they do? I cannot possibly fathom the Lakers going into next season with that same alignment of those three and with Westbrook in particular. They have to do something.
It doesn't matter how much time you give them together. It's not going to work.
It's not going to work.
Trio.
Unless he turns into a three-point shooter tomorrow to space the floor for LeBron and Anthony Davis, unless he turns into a defender tomorrow or a willing screen setter tomorrow, a willing anything off-ball movement guy. Like, it's just not going to happen.
I'll tell you this. On that shooting front, when I was in L.A. recently, I asked Frank Vogel, like, you know, do you see Russ becoming a perimeter shooter like Jason Kidd later in his career? And, yeah, he said to me, he said, you know, look, we've talked about that, and didn't really take it any further than that. After I asked that question at a press conference, I heard from people in the Lakers organization that were like, he didn't want to do that, he being Russ. Like, he didn't want to, doesn't think he needs to, you know, add that layer to his game. And, look, his shooting numbers the last few seasons reflect that. They have gone down. Free throw numbers. He's in the 60s again. He was in the 60s again this past season. Like, it's, to just put a button on it, like, there's a chance. I don't know what the percentage is, but there's a chance we have seen the last game Russell Westbrook played in the NBA. And that's kind of a wild statement to make given, you know, the level of player he has been for most of his career. One other thing before we get to our awards. This is not going to be a playoff preview podcast, but I do want to just take a minute, take a beat here to note the importance of the Philadelphia 76ers series against the Toronto Raptors. The Sixers are in that 4-5 matchup. They go into the series against Toronto with Joel Embiid playing at an MVP level. They got James Harden. They will not have Matisse Thybulle for the games played in Canada because Thybulle confirmed that he was not vaccinated and cannot play in Canada as a result. The Sixers need to win this series, like, badly. They need to win this series, and maybe they need to even need to win one more if they play Miami in that second round. Because this offseason, they have a massive decision to make. In all likelihood, James Harden is going to want a four-year extension, four more years. I apologize if I'm saying this incorrectly, how the structure worked. But he's going to want a five-year deal. The last year of his contract and four more added onto it. That's going to take you to north of $250 million allocated to James Harden through, I believe, his age 38 season. James Harden to this point, Howard, has been very much a mixed bag. He's had as many bad games as he's had good with that team. He has looked, frankly, a step slow. He has looked lethargic. He's still not a defensive player. If they lose in this first round, I don't know what the Sixers do. Like, a first-round loss with Joel Embiid playing at that level to a Toronto team that's good but not great. They are not a championship-level team in Toronto. A first-round loss would be catastrophic for the 76ers. It just would be. Because now, Daryl Morey and that ownership group would be in the position of like, all right, we already kind of knew that year, like, 3, 4, and 5 of this James Harden contract would be bad. I'm reminded of what Bobby Marks, our friend over at ESPN, said, where he said James Harden at the back end of that deal, if it came through, that would be the worst contract in NBA history, like, flat out. And Bobby is not prone to hyperbole. So if they go down this series, I honestly don't know how, what the Sixers would do in that situation. I think this is one of the most important playoff series in the history of the Sixers franchise, because if you can't get playoff success with James Harden alongside Joel Embiid, you are in extreme danger of blowing the next few prime years of Joel Embiid's career.
Yeah, there's a few things on the line. Sixers might have some stuff going on. Sixers always have stuff going on. My gosh. I don't disagree with anything you're saying here, Chris. And the Raptors are really good and really different and weird in the best ways, with all these guys who are all tall and long with big wingspans, and they can all handle the ball and pass and shoot. And look, Joel Embiid is unguardable, and on Embiid alone, the Sixers can and should win this series. But these teams are not that far apart in terms of the regular season record. They're certainly not that far apart if you going over the last, you know, couple months of the season after the Raptors really kind of found themselves. And, you know, as unguardable as Embiid is, I don't know how the Sixers deal with all the Raptors' various weapons, because it's really hard to guard a team where, look, they don't have that one superstar, they don't have an Embiid, and they don't have a Harden, but they have a bunch of guys who can do stuff. And the Sixers aren't that well equipped on the perimeter defensively as it is to deal with Anunoby and Siakam and Scotty Barnes and Fred VanVleet, assuming good health and all that. Like, there's just a lot of stuff to pay attention to defensively, and the Sixers, their depth isn't great. Their bench hasn't been great all season. It's been worse since the trade because they gave up some key pieces. And Matisse Thybulle, as you point out, unvaccinated, cannot play games 3 and 4 in Toronto, can't play a potential game 6 in Toronto. That could really bite them in the ass. And if they lose in the first round, man, the consequences there, not as catastrophic an end as what we just saw with the Lakers, you know, missing the play-in entirely with their top-heavy roster, but the Sixers are certainly all in on this Harden-Embiid alignment. Daryl Morey is fully invested in this. We were already hearing speculation about Doc Rivers' future. This is a very high-stakes series for Philly.
Yeah, I mean, look, Daryl believes in James Harden, always has. Acquired him from Oklahoma City back in Houston and watched him blossom into a superstar. But you wonder, like, if this series and this postseason doesn't go the way that Philadelphia wants, like, was he too loyal to him? Was he too fixated on him? Was there a better deal, whether it was a Bradley Beal in Washington or some kind of package available from Atlanta that would have made more sense for Ben Simmons, that would have given them a player that, or players that fit in just as well alongside Joel Embiid? From the time I spent with Embiid out in LA a couple of weeks ago, one thing he kept saying over and over again is, like, just put shooters around me, man. That's what I tell the front office all the time. Put shooters around me. Like, he brought up Seth Curry a couple of times with me, you know, during our conversation. So I think this has the potential to have some long-term impact on Philadelphia if this series does not go the Sixers' way. All right, Howard, the time is now to reveal our MVP ballots. I'm going to let you go first with your MVP ballot. So let her rip, baby. Who do you have as your 2021-22 NBA MVP?
Should I just spit it out, or should we go from 5 up to 1?
I think you got to start with 1. Like, let's just go with 1, and we'll go down the list. That's the big deal. That's the big number.
That is the big deal. The top of my MVP ballot, the first line went to Giannis Antetokounmpo.
Oh, Giannis. I thought you were going to go Jokic. All right. Go ahead. Continue.
After which were Jokic and Embiid. Fourth was Luka, and fifth was Steph Curry.
Okay. Your rationale then for Giannis at number 1.
All right. So listen, I know there's a massive amount of momentum for Jokic and has been for months. And I think he will probably win it. And he's probably, in many ways, as deserving this year as he was last year. I voted for Jokic at the top of my ballot last year, so I want to make that very, very clear. This is not some anti-Jokic thing. I'm not anti-anybody. I voted for Jokic last season. If people read my column, you'll see the hints all there. I did not say who my MVP was in the column, but you could see the outline of my rationale for not just this MVP vote, but all of my MVP votes over the years. This is not strictly a player award. This is not most outstanding season. This is not best statistical season. This is not best traditional stat season. This is not best advanced stat season. The MVP traditionally in this league for the last 41 years, minus 2 of them, the MVP has come from a team that is clearly one of the best in the league that year. Whether you want to define that by place in the standings, no lower than third in your conference most years for this award, or whether you want to define it by win total, 50-win teams and up, or the equivalent in a shortened season, right? Two pandemic shortened seasons, one lockout, or two lockout shortened seasons. It's always been a guy off a 50-win team. 50 is a really important marker in the NBA. There are good teams that win 45, 47, 48 games. The best teams, the ones that have a chance for a deep playoff run and maybe a championship, win 50 and up. That's the marker in this league. And 39 of the last 41 MVPs, 39 came from teams that won 50 or more or the equivalent in a shortened season. That matters to me, not because it's some ironclad precedent that I must reflexively follow its tradition. It's not that. It's that when we talk about MVP and the debates about MVP, and we say, well, there's no definition for MVP. The ballot just says most valuable player. There's no definition. So how do we understand what the award represents then, Chris? Well, we understand what it represents by considering the scope of history, of all that came before, and saying, are there commonalities that link Larry Bird to Kobe Bryant, to Michael Jordan, to Giannis Antetokounmpo, who's obviously won it back-to-back recently, to Steve Nash, to Dirk Nowitzki, to Shaq, to Kareem, to Magic? Like, what unites them all? What gives us the through line that helps us understand MVP? You look at how they got there. You look at the teams they were on. Nearly every season, with the exception of Russell Westbrook in 2017 and Moses Malone back in, I think it was 82, every other season, the MVP came from a team that was a clear contender or damn close, plausible contender. We don't reward MVP in this league, generally speaking, most of the time, to great players on good teams, middling teams, plucky teams, mediocre teams, overachieving teams. We reward MVP to players on great teams. And so it comes from a smaller pool. So this isn't holding it against Jokic that he didn't have Jamal Murray and Michael Porter Jr. to help him. It's saying that by definition, the MVP is about both player excellence and team success in concert with each other. And based on that standard, and I believe it matters, and I believe trying to have some consistency over four decades matters and has mattered, Giannis is the guy. Now, if you want to go down to like individual stats, advanced stats, and do the comparisons, people have, and Jokic charts out better individually. That's fine. I get that. It's not the most outstanding player. It never has been. And people say, well, Jokic made history. Just as a quick example, and then I'll shut up for a minute. Every season somebody's making history now, partially because of the pace of the game, the style of the game, the fact that guys have higher usage rates than ever. If you're a star, you get more possessions, and we have more possessions in the NBA anyway right now. So history's being made all the time. So saying Jokic is having a historical season, guess who's also having a historical season? Giannis Antetokounmpo, averaging 29.9 points, 11.6 rebounds, 5.8 assists. If you go to Basketball Reference, to their Stathead tool, plug in 29 points, 11 rebounds, 5 assists. The only guys who have done that in NBA history, Wilt Chamberlain twice, Oscar Robertson once, Elgin Baylor once, oh, and Giannis Antetokounmpo once before in 2019-20 when he won MVP. If I add in the averaging a block a game and assist per game, that list goes from 6 times and 4 players down to 1. Just Giannis. So this whole thing about making history, Giannis is now the only player in history, and I say this slightly tongue-in-cheek because, again, play around with Stathead, you can always find combinations to make something the first of ever. Giannis is the first ever to average 29 points, 11 rebounds, 5 or more assists, and at least a block a game and a steal a game. He does it at a high efficiency. He does it for one of the best teams in the league. He does it for a team that's a clear contender. And the Nuggets are, I'm sorry, the Nuggets are not a contender. The Bucks are. And that is the short-ish version of how I came to my decision.
All right, quickly, 4 and 5 on your list?
4 and 5 on my ballot?
Ballot, yeah.
Yeah, Doncic and then Curry.
Yeah, okay.
And by the way, the standard of contender applies to that top slot. It's obviously you have to lower everything on both ends as you're going down the ballot. So it's sure. Not... It, you know, just to be clear.
Sure, sure. All right. The top of my ballot, the number one position on Chris Mannix's MVP ballot went to Joel Embiid. Now, you made a good argument for the statistics. It's one that I made as well because, as you know, in the days and weeks before the balloting closes, you get flooded with statistical accomplishments of the players that are in the mix. And every one of these top three guys, Embiid, Jokic, Giannis, has accomplished something great statistically. Yes. You mentioned Giannis' accomplishments. I'll throw in something the Bucks sent me. Only NBA player ranking in the top 15 in points per game, rebounds per game, blocks per game, and effective field goal percentage, which I'm sure nobody that, you know, casually watches the NBA game knows what that is. Jokic, of course, every advanced stat out there, Jokic leads it. Everyone, every acronym you can think of, Jokic is at the top. He can make an extremely compelling case. You look at Embiid, the NBA scoring champ this year. First center to average 30-plus points per game since 1982. So you can make an incredible arc. That, and he's double-teamed all the time. Like, you know, so I think that's another part of the statistical argument that goes to Joel Embiid. So you kind of got to, if it's that close, at least for me, you almost block out the numbers. Start to look beyond the numbers a little bit. And I start to look at the intangibles. You mentioned one, being on a title contender. That has, as you said, largely been a criteria among voters for winning, for being number one on the MVP ballot. And Jokic, for as good as the Nuggets are, maybe they can win a first-round series. Who knows? Like, they're a good team. They're not a title contender at this point. So then you look at other things. And the big thing I looked at, and that one of the things that swayed me in the way towards Joel Embiid, was just how much of a rock he was this season for Philadelphia. During an incredibly tumultuous year, Joel Embiid held that team together more than Doc Rivers, more than Daryl Morey, more than anyone in that organization. Joel Embiid held that team together. This team was in chaos from day one. Their all-NBA point guard, like, shows up in the middle of the night before a preseason game, occasionally pops into the facility, gets thrown out of a practice, and Joel Embiid keeps the focus on the main thing, on winning with that group. How many times, Howard, was Joel Embiid afforded the opportunity to just take the proverbial 2x4 and swing it in the direction of Ben Simmons? Like, Joel Embiid is the most powerful athlete in Philadelphia, in a sports town that is rabid. He is the most powerful athlete in Philadelphia. He controls the mob, and he could have unleashed the mob on Ben Simmons. But for three quarters of a season, whatever it was before Simmons actually got traded, Embiid kept the focus on the team there, kept them aimed at winning games, didn't complain about not having an all-NBA point guard with him, was happy, would talk, you know, glowingly about Tyrese Maxey, Seth Curry, all the guys that were there, and he kept that team together. I know Jokic did the same thing. Jokic, they were down Jamal Murray, they were down Michael Porter Jr., but that was different circumstances. Porter Jr. and Murray were injured. Simmons was just out. Simmons was like, I don't want to play in Philadelphia, I don't want to be there anymore, and Embiid kept that team together. To me, that was the intangible that pushed Embiid to the front of the line for me, because statistically, you could vote for any one of these guys, but only Embiid just kept that team, kept his team on the top of the standings during as trying a set of circumstances as you can imagine in recent memory. So that's why he was number one. I went with Jokic number two, and I went with Giannis at number three. Four and five were Luka, and I put Jason Tatum at number five because he has had an outstanding last 3.5 months of the season.
Well, and I'll just say this real quick. We'll get back to the top of our ballots in a second, but just to address the bottom part for a minute, it was almost as hard figuring out the four and five as it was ordering the top three. Everybody is going to have pretty much the same top three, I think. There might be a stray, you know, Devin Booker or maybe a Luka in the top three. Like, somebody might break it up. I think the vast majority of the 100 ballots will have some order of Embiid, Jokic, and Giannis.
I don't want this to be decided by like an I'm smarter than you MVP vote for like Steph Curry. Like, just don't do that. Don't do that.
I don't think anybody's doing that.
Like, don't give the proverbial think piece of voting. Like, I just don't. We know who the top three guys are right now. Let's not.
Occasionally somebody does go astray just for the sake of making some kind of statement about, I don't know, life, the universe. I think the top three will be pretty universal in some order or another. But the four and five were tough because you and I both had Luka in the fourth slot. You went Tatum five, I went Curry five, but I also considered Tatum, and I also considered Booker. And that foursome, Doncic, Curry, Booker, Tatum, was really, really hard to separate. And it starts becoming like just Eye of the Beholder or who you prefer or whose season you wanted to weight a little heavier based on the context of their team or whatever. It's hard. I have said in the past, I'll say it again, I think the MVP ballot could be a seven-man ballot. It would give us a chance to acknowledge more guys who were part of the quote-unquote conversation but weren't necessarily top three guys. I think probably what will happen is that so many of us, and this happens most years, we'll all do a different four and five. And so all of those guys we've named and some others will get their due. But I would love a deeper ballot because I think there's always a group of four or five guys who are worth considering for the last two to three slots. Going back to the top real quick. So my column that I had this week about, you know, I was kind of in tongue-in-cheek saying all your takes are wrong on MVP. But it was a lot of it was about like some false constructs and some cliches and just some, you know, a lot of silliness I've heard over the years that have just always kind of grated on me. One that I did not address was, oh, this guy just, he only won because of the narrative. Let me just address this for a second, because Giannis, it's no real narrative for Giannis. There is a Giannis, there's definitely a narrative for Jokic, and there's definitely a narrative for Embiid. But those narratives matter because what those narratives really are is context. It's context. You laid out the context for why Embiid's stats matter. It's not just that he produced all these gaudy numbers. It's that they were down a superstar in Ben Simmons, and in the worst possible way. It wasn't because he was just hurt. He was a net negative because of this distraction hanging over them. And the Sixers could have absolutely just fallen apart. And Embiid kept them on course. He raised the level of his game to some astounding levels. He's been absolutely dominant. And yes, in the face of what they were going through as a team, that matters. That's not narrative. That's context. Just as the case for Jokic is built on narrative slash context, which is look at all he did without his two co-stars. So people, stop like trotting out narrative in this pejorative way. Narrative just means story. And story is just explaining the broader context of something. So listen, you know, Embiid is absolutely worthy. I have no problem with your vote there. People going for Jokic, I have no problem with it either. Other than, as I say, I think it's more important to continue to have a consistency about who the award is for. I don't care that Jokic led in every possible advanced stat. It's impressive. It's not definitive. This was, again, one of the points I made in the column. Just because you lead in certain stats, traditional or advanced stats, it's not definitive. It's not authoritative. And the MVP award has always been about more than just who had the best statistical season, who had the most output. The context matters. The kind of team you're playing for matters. By the way, real quick, just as a reference point here, I know LeBron only played 56 games, but let's for the moment say that LeBron had played 70 and we weren't dismissing him based on games played. LeBron's numbers were MVP caliber numbers. LeBron put up monster numbers. And why aren't we talking about him even for the fifth slot? Oh, because the Lakers sucked, because they were a disaster. Why? So why does that matter? Because wins matter. Wins have always mattered. So everybody's got a cutoff somewhere. And if you're saying that that the cutoff is at 45 or 47 instead of 50, fine. But I'm just saying it's clear based on the history of the award, the winning has always mattered, and winning at the highest level has always mattered, except for Russ in 2017 and Moses Malone way back in the day.
All right, let's run through a couple of other awards here now. And let's go to Defensive Player of the Year, which is one of the most interesting DPOY votes I think that we've had in a while. It's been a long time since the late 1990s, mid-1990s, since a guard has won this award. A point guard has only won this award one time. That was back in Gary Payton won that award in the mid-1990s. 39 times the award has been handed out. A point guard has only won it that one time. But this year, Marcus Smart is in the mix. You got a wing player like Mikal Bridges in the mix. Rudy Gobert, the stalwart, is in the mix. Howard, tell me, how did your Defensive Player of the Year ballot shake out?
This one was really tough because I don't think we had a clear-cut leader, and we had a lot of recent winners who, for various reasons, weren't as firmly in the mix or didn't have a strong hold on it. I went with Marcus Smart, And a lot of that was, I had a thousand conversations over the last several days before our ballots were due with some scouts and coaches and team execs. There was kind of a consensus, I felt like, for Marcus Smart over some of the bigs. So I went Smart just ahead of Jaren Jackson Jr. in the second slot, and Bam Adebayo third. Bam had a phenomenal case to be number one overall, but he didn't play enough games, and so that mattered in the end. But the Celtics, as you know, were absolutely dominant defense for the last few months of the season. And, you know, I was always trying to parse out, is it more about Marcus Smart? Is it more about Robert Williams? Is it the combination of the two? How do you separate them? And the consistent message I got, as I said, when I was just kind of polling smarter basketball people around the league, is that this is about Marcus Smart. You know, Robert Williams' job is in some ways a lot easier because he's just kind of the free safety. He's going to clean up a lot of messes, but he's not the linchpin of their defense in the way that Giannis is in Milwaukee or that Gobert has been in his best years in Utah. So that's the way it played out for me.
I went with Marcus Smart at the top of my ballot too. You know, look, Rudy Gobert was number two on my list, and Mikal Bridges number three on mine. Rudy is still an incredibly dominant defensive force. His on-off numbers...
And was on my all-defensive teams, by the way.
Yeah, like, on-off numbers are nearly absurd. I think there's like an 8-point difference or something on-off with Rudy Gobert. That's just a wild stat. He's going to be a front-runner for DPOY every single year. I just, you know, and again, I do the same thing you do. I run a lot of these questions by scouts and coaches that I know and get their take on it. I don't think Rudy was as dominant defensively as he's been in years past. And the Jazz were, you know, even in games he played in, were kind of bleh. They blew some leads in games he played in. And look, they're just not as, they're just not as versatile when he's out there on the floor. Like, the case for Smart, you know, look, you can run through his accolades. Top five in the NBA in steals, top five in defensive win shares. He's first in loose balls recovered per game. He's top 10 in defensive rating, deflections, charges. The Celtics had the best defensive rating in the NBA per NBA.com. And since January 1st, I was looking this up, they had a better defensive rating than anybody else. I think Phoenix was in second place by more than 3 points. That's a big gap between first and second. Smart was the head of the snake on that. The Celtics defense is a switch-heavy defense. They switch everything on that team. And you could only do that if you have a player like Marcus Smart who can switches all five guys. And you look at some of the advanced stats there. When Marcus Smart does switch, more often than not, the guy he switches on, he doesn't score. I was listening to something Quinn Snyder said when he came through Boston recently, talking about comparing Smart to an elite cornerback in the NFL, where, like, you don't even want to go near him at times. Like, if you have a guy being guarded by Marcus Smart, he almost becomes a decoy out there on the floor. So I went with Smart. Like, he is the key to that Celtics defense. He runs through a million screens, you know, a week. His versatility has just been invaluable for a Celtics team that had the best defense in the NBA. So Smart was, I agree with you, Smart was my call.
Yeah, listen, this is always one of the toughest ones to vote on anyway, just because, you know, this is not one that you can, like, you can make it somewhat stat-based, but defensive stats are kind of wonky and not as definitive, and none of us see all 82 games of every team, and, you know, defensive assignments and schemes have something to do with whether or not you are a good defender, whether a coach considers you a good defender. You can watch a given game where someone locks up a player and think, oh my God, that guy's been fantastic, but it doesn't mean they do it every night. It's just, it's really tough. I find that one is, it's the one I always do last because I just don't want to deal with it sometimes. it's hard to get your head around. It is not as easily analyzed, I think, as a lot of the others.
Yeah, I agree. All right, let's move on to Rookie of the Year, which I think is going to be another really interesting vote. You've got a pretty deep rookie class. At the top of it, Cade Cunningham, drafted number one, put up some big numbers for the Pistons this year. Evan Mobley played exceptional in Cleveland. Scotty Barnes was great in Toronto. Take me through your rookie of the year ballot, Mr. Beck.
Yeah, I mean, listen, it was Barnes versus Mobley versus Cunningham, and I seriously considered all three of them, and I tested out my theories on some of them with some folks around the league. I thought I was going Mobley. At one point, I started seriously considering Cunningham, and I eventually landed on Scotty Barnes, with Mobley second and Cunningham third. And a lot of it just has to do with, and this is, you know, it's hard because, you know, Cunningham had the biggest burden. And this was my argument for Cunningham if I were going to vote for him. The case for him is that Cunningham had the heaviest burden. He went to the team with the least talent of those three guys. He produced at a high level. He's got a lot of responsibility as the point guard on this team. And he's, you know, as the number one overall pick, besides, you come in and you have to be the savior. Evan Mobley didn't have to be a savior. Scotty Barnes did not have to be a savior. Scotty Barnes joined a team, the Raptors, that still has the core of a group that won the championship. And that, you know, underachieved last season. They were always better than their record. So you knew they were going to have a better season. And Evan Mobley joined a team that had Jared Allen to do most of the dirty work down low so that he could roam a little and not have to deal with the bigger bodies, because Mobley's still pretty skinny. And Darius Garland has a breakout season. And so, you know, I could have argued myself in circles on this one. In the end, Barnes played, I think, the most important role in the most important way for an important team. The Raptors' success, their revival, the fact that we're talking about them as possibly a team that could pull an upset in the first round is due at least in part to Scotty Barnes playing like a veteran, playing multiple positions with a lot of different responsibilities, playing some point forward along the way, being able to defend multiple positions. He's just done a lot for an important team. And while I don't usually take wins into account in Rookie of the Year, it's just who's the best rookie, who had the best rookie season. In this case, with three really strong candidates, you start to bring in other factors. And I think the fact that Barnes played in a really important role, that was his burden, right? His burden was, you can't just go out there and just get a bunch of reps and us lose games while you put up numbers and have it be okay. It's not okay. We need to win. And so his burden was almost the inverse of Cade Cunningham's. But again, I have no qualms with people going any direction with those three guys on this one. It does feel like there's a lot of Barnes momentum out there.
Yeah, there's a lot of Barnes momentum over the last couple of weeks, at least. And look, it's deserved. I mean, there was a stretch where, was it like early March or something like that, where, you know, Nick Nurse was playing like six guys out there. Like, in Scotty Barnes, I'm looking at some of these minutes played numbers. March 1st against Brooklyn, 41 minutes. Two nights later against Detroit, 40 minutes. Three nights later against Cleveland, 42 minutes. He was then 34, 37, 39, 40, 40, 40, 42, 42. Like, up until late March, he was running out there close to 40 minutes per game, like every night, carrying a huge burden for that Raptors team. So I definitely like what he did. I voted for Evan Mobley, though. So before I get into why Mobley, So Cunningham may turn out to be the best player in this group. He had a phenomenal offensive season. Like, he's a tremendously talented player and overcame that sluggish start first couple of weeks, 2-3 weeks of the season, to show he has all the tools to be a great offensive player. But the Pistons didn't, like, play a meaningful game all season long. Like, they were never in the mix for anything. And I factor that in when I start to weigh a close decision like Rookie of the Year was. When I looked at the numbers for Mobley and for Barnes, and look, where I kind of disagree with you, I mean, I think, I know that Mobley had some guys around him, but so did Scottie Barnes. Like, he had Pascal Siakam, he had Fred VanVleet. Like, he had some good players. He had one of the best coaches in all of basketball on that team. So he had guys as well. And look at the numbers. The final numbers are almost identical. I mean, Mobley, 15 points, 8 rebounds, couple of assists, 50% from the floor. Barnes, 15 points, 7.5 rebounds, 3 assists, 50% from the floor. A little bit better from 3-point range, but, you know, he's a wingman and Mobley is a big. the defensive numbers are where Mobley starts to separate. And I looked at one in particular, shots contested. I mean, because you can look at the blocks and steals and numbers that are in traditional stats, but shots contested is really interesting to me because that, you know, shows me kind of where a guy is on the floor at all times. Contested two-point shots, Evan Mobley. Not surprisingly, he's in the top 10, nearly 9 per game. He's a big man, plays close to the rim. You expect him to be in that range. Three-point shots contested. And Evan Mobley's what, like 6'10", 6'11"? Big guy out there. Three-point shots contested. As I just lost my stats here, but I'll find... Yeah, three-point shots contested. The league leader this year was Andrew Wiggins, who contested 4.3 shots per game. Barnes was at 3.7. Most of the players, Howard, on this list are guards and small forwards, as you'd expect. They're defending three-point shots. Evan Mobley contested 3.6 three-point shots per game. That is Anthony Davis, Robert Williams territory. Like, he was everywhere out there on the floor defensively, getting after perimeter shooters. That was his defensive prowess gave him the edge on my ballot. Very close. Scotty Barnes was number 2. Cade Cunningham was number 3. But Evan Mobley's ability to be like an all defensive candidate in his first season, that gave him the edge to me in Rookie of the Year.
Listen, I think that's all fair. And as I say, like I could have argued myself in circles on this. Their jobs were different, right? And that's the thing, like Rookie of the Year in a lot of years, it's just who had the best stats among the rookies, right? And again, when you're drafted high to a bad team, as most top rookies are, you're going to have a ton of opportunity, and more so when you are a point guard like Cade Cunningham with the ball in your hands all the time. Their jobs were all just fundamentally different. You just described Mobley's. Scotty Barnes's was different because of the role he played with the Raptors. Scotty Barnes is, I think, the most skilled of the three right now, or has the most versatile skill set, and I think clearly has a broader skill set and can do more things for the Raptors than Mobley currently does for the Cavs. Mobley may evolve into that. He may be a multi-tool offensive weapon as well.
Maybe, Howard, I don't know if I really agree with that, because Mobley, like, when Jared Allen went out, Mobley just slid over to the center, and he played really well for them in that position.
Oh, for sure. I just meant that, like, Barnes can initiate your offense. Like Barnes can be like this. Like you could put him at almost any position offensively, and run stuff through him. Mobley, I think, can become that guy too. I just think that Barnes has the more versatile offensive skill set at the moment, plus the defensive versatility, being able to you know guard multiple spots, which Mobley has too. So you know it's close. I think this will be a very close vote. But yeah, it's a great rookie class, period.
Yeah, excellent. The all rookie teams, which we'll get into another time, were another tough call because there were so many talented guys that had an opportunity to make that list. Finally, Howard, Coach of the Year. I'll go first on this one. The question of Coach of the Year top my ballot really wasn't one. I mean, I went with Monty Williams. The Suns have been, wire to wire, the best team in the NBA, basically, like for the vast majority of this season. And it has not been a season without, you know, bumps along the way. Like, they began the season with the turmoil that comes from an owner that is accused of some reprehensible things, misogyny, racism, things like that, that put a spotlight on the organization. I thought Monty Williams' ability to be a kind of steadying voice throughout that was really important to this team. And the end of the season, look, they played 17 games without Chris Paul. They went 11-6. They were able to overcome the loss of a guy that before the injury might have been on our MVP ballots as well. So, you know, for the success of the Suns and how Monty navigated turbulent times, he finished number one. Number two was more of a tougher call for me. I went with Ime Udoka of the Celtics. And I did that because Ime, the first couple of months of the season, this team looked completely dysfunctional. But Ime Udoka was able to, you know, turn this team around, get them headed in the right direction, to the point that the Celtics finished the regular season as the number 2 seed in the Eastern Conference. That is remarkable. Like, where this team was in, like, late December, when they were getting clobbered by Greg Monroe and the Minnesota Timberwolves, to where they are right now is a real credit to Ime Udoka. He inherited a team that had clearly atrophied, that needed to be shaken up, that needed to be verbally beat up a little bit. And he spent 2 months doing that, breaking them of all the bad habits, installing a switching defense that they weren't used to playing. And then by early January, it all clicked. And it has been
smooth sailing for the Celtics since then. They have been on the rise since early January with an elite defense, excellent playmaking. Marcus Smart's development as a playmaker, I think, is in part part of the argument for Ime Udoka. Jason Tatum, gone to another level. Jaylen Brown, gone to another level. Rob Williams showed the kind of toughness this year that I haven't seen from him in years past. That's another credit to Ime Udoka. He edged Taylor Jenkins on my ballot for number two for Coach of the Year. So for me, Monty Williams was easy. Two and three were very tough. Very tough.
So all three of those guys were under consideration for me as well, in addition to, seven others, I think. I went through, 11 or 12 a couple weeks ago on the podcast. We talked about all the great candidates. And, you know, again, you just have to finally decide which impressive feat you most want to reward. I voted for Monty Williams at the top of the ballot last year. Monty Williams should have won it last year, and in fact, he got more first-place votes than any other candidate, but Tom Thibodeau won on points. I think he just got more seconds than Monty or something, but the math worked in Tibbs' favor. Monty got more first-place votes last year. I had Monty second this time. I seriously considered him putting him first again, but I felt like the Suns' biggest leap, Monty Williams' biggest impact on them, came last season when they leapt from perennial lottery team to NBA finals team. And of course, in the regular season, we didn't know they'd go to the finals, and we file our ballots after the regular season. But they leapt all the way to near the top of the Western Conference. And Monty Williams, I thought, did an incredible job to do that. What they did this season was simply building on that. And so to me, that's not as big of a... It's not that it isn't impressive. It's just not as impressive as the leap you made last year or the leap that, say, the Memphis Grizzlies made this year, which is why Taylor Jenkins was top of my ballot this season. The Grizzlies cracked the playoffs last year just barely. Went through this season where they missed Ja Morant for like 24 games and went 20-4, I believe, without him. Had massive leaps from Jaren Jackson and Desmond Bane, and they played a ton of games without Dylan Brooks, who was really important to them. They've just got this group of guys who are all like, none of them are household names aside from Ja Morant, who just became a household name. And the Grizzlies won, 55, 56 games? And
20 of them without Ja Morant. Like, right. That stat is remarkable. 20-5 without Ja Morant.
Number two in the Western Conference, ahead of the Warriors, ahead of Dallas with Luka, ahead of Denver with Jokic. I mean, we talked about MVP for Jokic, his MVP case. Like, Ja's not making it this season for a bunch of different reasons, including a lot of games missed. But, you know, how much help does Ja have around him? How much high-level help? And you look at Jaren Jackson Jr. is obviously becoming a very, very good player. But it's not like he's got superstars around him. That team just plays its ass off. And when you're talking about the character of a team, a lot of that has to do with the players you get. But we talk about team culture. The Grizzlies' culture is as great as anybody's in the league. When you are winning that consistently without Ja, that's a credit to Taylor Jenkins and his staff and that whole franchise for the culture they've cultivated there, where they play hard every game. They play for each other. Their chemistry is outstanding. That the coach deserves credit for that in exactly the same way that Monty Williams deserves credit for that, not only this season, but last season, in bringing together a Suns team that to that point had some talent but couldn't pull it all together. And so it was hard. Because Monty didn't win it last year, I really wanted to go there, but that's the wrong reason. I didn't want to vote for him this time again just because I thought he should have gotten it last year. On the merits, on this season alone, I thought Taylor Jenkins had the slightly stronger case. Monty Williams I had second, and then I had Tyronn Lue third. What the Clippers did with no Kawhi Leonard all season, no Paul George for most of the season, has been absolutely incredible. And again, that's, you know, Ty Lue had those guys playing their butts off every night and getting the best out of everybody. And that's the coach's job.
Can't argue with any of those. That Ja Morant stat is unbelievable. 20-5 without a guy that, if he had been healthy all season long, would have probably been the top five, maybe even the top four in your MVP ballot. Just unbelievable. Like, and I remember Brad Jones, the assistant coach with Memphis, telling me during the season when he was filling in for Taylor during a COVID issue, was like, that guy, and Brad's been around, was like, that guy is the most prepared coach I've ever worked with. Like, he's just on point when it comes to preparation, strategy, things like that. He's elite. So I have no issue, Howard, with your ballot either. I have no issue with any of your ballots because these awards were
wildly close. All right. We'll have, I'm sure, our ballots up on SI.com at some point in the next couple of days as well. Coming up next, Howard's conversation with Trae Young.
Now, pleased to be joined by two-time All-Star Trae Young. Trae, I know you're working with Body Armor and their new campaign. We'll get to that momentarily, but we got to start, of course, with the playoffs. It's coming up in a few days. As you and I record this, we don't know exactly where you guys will be slotted, but we do know you're going in the play-in round first without the security of a playoff berth. What's it like going into the postseason with a little bit more of that uncertainty?
Definitely not the feeling we were hoping for. But the East is tough this year. It's a tough year in the East, and there's a lot of teams still battling to make the playoffs. So that play-in tournament is going to be filled with some really good teams.
It's been, and you kind of alluded to this, I mean, it's been a kind of a bumpy year for you guys, and definitely a tougher year in the East in general, and you guys have been dealing with injuries, John Collins in particular. How would you describe the way this season has gone, and especially in contrast, obviously, the big breakthrough for you guys last spring?
Yeah, it's definitely been like a roller coaster type of year for us. I mean, obviously, you kind of started off the year pretty good, and then, COVID really hit our team really hard, and there was a time where teams were getting games postponed, and we were actually playing games with three and four guys from our original roster on our team. And it was just a tough time, and we were losing a lot of games. And then obviously starting to pick it back up as of late. So it's been like a roller coaster type of year, but we're obviously clicking at the right time, and hopefully we can string together a run.
So you guys make the Eastern Conference Finals last year. No one sees this coming. And at that moment, I think everybody's looking at you guys like, and I certainly saw you guys this way, you're a young team with a ton of talent, and maybe you broke through a little sooner than I expected or anybody else expected, but it does look like a breakthrough. And I'm sure you guys are thinking too, like, okay, we've arrived and this should be the new normal. Did it feel that way? Did you come into this season thinking, all right, we know how to do this. We know how to get to be at least an Eastern Conference Finals team. And then how do you adjust along the way as you realize, like, oh, no, there's going to be a few curves and we're going to have to kind of reestablish this thing?
Yeah, I was excited because I felt like everybody's expectations were starting to catch up to mine. Because I always feel like I have high expectations for my team, and even last year, and then obviously coming into this year, I had high expectations for it. So, obviously, with those high expectations, you have to be ready for each and every game and getting teams better shots and not. Every team obviously saw what we were doing and the run we made, so wanting to come in and it wasn't taking us lightly at all. So I think it's really just a mindset that you have to have to be able to be a great team, and I think we have a lot of young guys and we're still learning that. I think that's where we got to be better at moving forward, and because you want to be in a higher seed and higher standing going into the playoffs and to make the run for a championship easier for you. So I think we all learned that this year, and I think it'll help us move forward.
What about for you, Trae? I mean, obviously, look, you're a two-time All-Star. You're still very young in this league overall, but you're a veteran of sorts now and a leader on this team by virtue of your role. How has it honed your own leadership along the way to go through a bumpy season like this, try to keep it together? How have you honed your own leadership? Is it more of a leadership by example and setting a tone, or have you become more vocal along the way? How have you tried to kind of imprint yourself on the team?
Yeah, I've definitely, I tell people all the time, I've always been a really good leader by example, and leading vocally is something I've always had to continue to get better at, even since college. And so now, being a couple years in, I'm starting to even be more vocal and to my teammates, especially on the court. And I think it starts with off the court and our relationship, and I mean, how close we are, and it's been great. And so, yeah, I mean, just leading vocally and leading, I mean, by an example. I mean, when we're going through the tough stretches, I have to keep my head, and because I know my teammates are looking to see what I'm doing and see the type of energy that I have, and I hope I mean, I just try to be a great leader by example, and I'm still obviously trying to be better vocally, and I feel like I'm at a good place, but I can continue to get better at that too.
What does Nate McMillan tell you about that? I mean, obviously he's a pretty powerful voice himself, and obviously logged a lot of years in the league at guard. So is he? What's his best advice to you along the way, especially in the tougher times?
I mean, he's just. I mean, his information to me is more just positive and just to stay positive with my teammates. And I mean, he just really believes in me, and it's awesome having a coach that believes in you and believes in your ability to take over games and to lead a team. And I know I have a coach that believes in me, and I think anytime that, I mean, he says that, he just gives me more confidence to go out there and just play my best and try to get a win for him. So I think that's the best thing that he's given me, is just more confidence and just telling me how much he believes in me and what I can do for this team.
So Trey, by the time this interview comes out, the ballots will all be in for all the postseason awards, including all NBA. A lot's been talked about and written, of course, because for you, there's a lot of money on the line too. If you are all NBA, you qualify for the Supermax, all that. Whether it's about the money or whether it's just about the honor itself, what do you think it would mean to you to make all NBA this season?
Man, to be honest with you, I haven't talked about all NBA. I haven't talked about individual awards all year, and I don't plan on it today. So, yeah. I've been really excited about my team. And, I mean, when it comes to all NBA, last year I was 25. I had a pretty good season. We were the fifth seed, and I wasn't all NBA. So I really just want to focus on my team. And then after the year, after the season, I'll start answering questions like that.
For sure. No, I respect that answer for sure. A fun one here. Your dad, I'm following your dad on Twitter. He is super active on Twitter. I think he might be more active on Twitter than you are. A lot of it's just about stuff, you know, pop culture, TV, whatever. But there's also a lot of like defending you, promoting you, whatever the day kind of calls for. How aware are you of your dad's Twitter feed? Do you enjoy it? Are you ever like doing the like, you know, oh, kind of like, hey, chill, dad. Like, I don't, you know, I'm good here. Or like, how do you feel about his Twitter feed?
No, it's definitely. I mean, he's a dad. He's gonna support. I mean, I'm very supportive of him. I don't mind him showing love and supporting his son. There's definitely been times I'm like, hey, dad, you can calm down a little bit. But I mean, for the most part, he's given, I mean, good advice to other parents, and I mean, he's on there to talk and what other people are on there doing. So I mean, as long as he never goes too far or whatever, I don't ever really say anything. He enjoys it. I mean, he's on there more for positivity too anyway. So
yeah,
that's a good thing.
No, it's fun. I like that aspect of it, because even when he's going to bat for you, he's always doing it in kind of a positive way. He's not trying to beat anybody over the head with anything. So it's been pretty enjoyable following him. All right, let me throw one more creative one at you before we talk about body armor a little bit. This was the 75th anniversary season for the league, of course. We had the 75th anniversary team. In 2046, they will, of course, have the 100th anniversary team. I will be retired long before then, I think, and you probably will too. It's a ways off. Give me five names, Trey, who will make new names that'll make the 100th anniversary team.
Ooh, five new names.
You can include yourself, question. Of course.
I mean, of course, I feel I'm going to be in there. My guy Luca is going to be in there. Jason Tatum, my guy. Wait, that's three.
That's three.
Dang, there's a lot of young dudes. D Book is gonna be in there. And it's crazy because you don't know. There could be a guy in 5 years that comes in the league and is tearing up the league. So I'll probably leave that last spot open for somebody 5 years down the road.
No, that's a good call. That's a good call. There's so much talent still coming in. All right, before we let you go, we mentioned Body Armor and their new One More campaign. Tell us about your involvement with Body Armor and what the One More campaign means to you.
Oh, yeah. I mean, obviously, Body Armor, I don't have very many partnerships, and but Body Armor is one of my biggest partners, and it's a family partnership, and being able to have my family, my little brother in the One More campaign, it's just an incredible feeling. And I mean, I'm looking forward to everybody seeing it. I know my parents are happy that they get to see two of their sons in there. But this is going to be a crazy campaign. And obviously Body Armor is very important to me and my everyday life, my hydration, but I mean, just in general. So I think it's going to be pretty cool. I can't wait for everybody to see it.
Awesome. Look forward to seeing that as well. And look forward to seeing how you and the Hawks do the rest of the way. Trey Young, thank you so much for your time and best of luck to you and the squad the rest of the way.
Fall's here, and so are incredible sales at Tanger Outlets. Find must-have handbags, footwear, and all the latest fall arrivals, all at unbeatable savings. Shop top brands like Nike Factory, Crocs, J. Crew Factory, Coach, Gap Factory, Old Navy Outlet, Under Armour, and even more brands you love. Save more every time you shop with deals up to 70% off. Tanger Outlets, always on trend, always on sale. Plan your trip at tanger.com.